crewed with people from Lucas's youth, many of them friends from film school. But with many either drifted away, retired, or moved on to larger things, Lucas needed a newer, younger crew. Young Indy marks the beginning of the second stage of Lucas's career, when he would find a new entourage and a new way of producing films. He would even find himself back behind the camera, directing segments of the series. In effect, it was a rebirth of sorts. Gary Kurtz would morph into Rick McCallum, Willard Hike and Gloria Katz into Frank Darabont and Jonathan Hales, Haskell Wexler into David Tattersall, and Walter Murch into Ben Burt. To manage the Young Indy series, Lucas would recruit Rick McCallum as producer. This would be the start of a collaboration that would span decades. McCallum easily filled the role as producer, and so impressed Lucas that he stayed on board for every subsequent Lucasfilm production. Young Indy, Radioland Murders, Star Wars Trilogy Special Edition, the Star Wars Prequel Trilogy, and the two subsequent Star Wars TV series. Costume designer Tricia Bigger, production designer Gavin Bouquet, and more minor players such as set decorator Peter Walpole and editor Ben Burt, famous for being the sound designer on the Star Wars trilogy, now trying his hand at picture cutting, would also find their start on the series. The creative core of the trilogy would be forged during the Young Indy run, nearly all of them getting their first big break with the series. We all had enormous fun doing the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, and I think that re-energized George to a degree. Writer Jonathan Hales recalled fondly in the cinema of George Lucas. I remember Rick McCallum saying excitedly, "We could go anywhere with this, do anything." And that enthusiasm was certainly infectious. It was a unique working situation, and the ranch was a fascinating working environment. I spent many years working on that series, and it was a great experience. It was the best job I've ever had. The series was envisioned by Lucas as being a vehicle to educate young people through entertainment. Lucas would come up with the stories himself, researching each episode's historic background, and work with a team of writers to develop the ideas into screenplays. They would come to the office every day, and George would tell them these stories. Assistant Jane Bay explained to author Marcus Hearn. They were based on historical information, most of which he knew, but some of which came from research provided by the library. It was the first time he had collaborated with a group of people in this way, and I have never seen him happier in a creative environment. The series would last from 1992 to 1993, and go on to win 10 Emmy Awards. It was critically acclaimed, especially with its big-budget look, but a changing time slot on ABC eventually led to low ratings, and the series was canceled. The remaining episodes were later strung together to form made-for-television movies. The personal success of the show was enough to make Lucas seriously consider the prequels. Not only were they fiscally tempting because of the Star Wars repopularization occurring, but now it was becoming technologically possible to make them the way Lucas imagined, without having to spend $200 million.
"I didn't take seriously the idea of doing prequels to Star Wars until I had the digital technology to do it," Lucas said.
By the time the Young Indy series had finished, it was 1993. That was a significant year for many reasons. The first was Jurassic Park. Lucas remembers the early CG tests ILM created in 1992, as he told the Wall Street Journal,
"We did a test for Steven Spielberg, and when we put them up on the screen, I had tears in my eyes. It was like one of those moments in history, like the invention of the light bulb or the first telephone call. A major gap had been crossed, and things were never going to be the same."
Jurassic Park would hit the world of cinema like a battering ram, bringing with it a new revolution. A digital revolution. No longer confined to metallic objects and inorganic robots, Jurassic Park showed that computers were capable of creating lifelike, living, breathing animals as authentic as anything in reality. It was an unexpected leap in technology that was even more thrilling to filmmakers than it was to audiences. For Lucas, it was a revelation. He told Wired,
"We had made such advances at Industrial Light and Magic, especially with Jurassic Park. That was the watershed of being able to create realistic characters using digital technology. So I thought about it again. I could do cities like Coruscant. I could do a pod race. I could do other things that up to that point had been impossible."
Lucas had always yearned to make abstract experimental films, and with the new digital advancements, he could have more creative freedom than ever. And yet, the prequel trilogy continued to pull at him. With his children growing older, Lucas finally had the chance to go back to directing as the 90s were being ushered in. But directing what? He looked back on that pivotal period in a 2004 interview with Charlie Rose.
"At the same time, my kids are getting older now. That's why I got to go back and do more Star Wars. And when I went back to do more Star Wars, I had a very soul-searching discussion with myself about, should I go off and do these three Star Wars, or should I go off and do these other movies that I want to do? And now my kids are old enough that I can go back and direct movies, which is what I wanted to do. And I opted for the Star Wars thing because, again, it was one of these, well, the opportunity is there, and I think I'd be foolish not to do it."
With the Star Wars series at an all-time high, there wasn't a better time to finally make the prequels. It was a lucky coinciding of elements.
"I realized the Star Wars audience was still alive, and it hadn't completely disappeared after 15 years, Lucas said to Wired. "I decided that if I didn't do the backstory then, I never would, so I committed to it."
He also dryly remarked,
"Part of the reason for doing it is that it's the first question I get asked. Not this is who I am or anything, but when are you going to do the next Star Wars? So if I do the next ones, hopefully people will introduce themselves first."
Moreover, the profits from the sure-to-be-lucrative trilogy would re-establish Lucas's independence after his 1983 divorce had snatched that dream away.
"I got a divorce, and that sort of set me back quite a ways," Lucas said to Charlie Rose in 2004. "And then I decided one of the reasons to go back to Star Wars was that it would hopefully make me financially secure enough to where I wouldn't have to go to a studio and beg for money."
Readying the second season of the Young Indie series, Lucas remarked in the Lucasfilm Fan Club magazine in 1992,
"I've said that I would always try to at least do the next trilogy, which is the first trilogy. I have said that I would start working on the next trilogy in the mid-90s, which is coming up pretty quickly, and that it would come out a year or two after we started. I'll probably start writing it in the next couple of years. Somewhere between 1995 and the year 2000, there should be three more Star Wars movies that will come out."
In the fall of 1993, Lucas formally announced in Variety, among other sources, that he would be finally making the Star Wars prequel trilogy. The announcement was a breath of fresh air for many fans. Although Lucas had been talking about making the Young Days of Ben Kenobi film since 1977, and technically officially announced them in May 1980 in Bantha Tracks, this was the first time it was actually confirmed. The films were going into production. First Steps. There were more Star Wars goings-on than simply the prequels that year. The 20th anniversary of Star Wars would soon be arriving in 1997, and Lucas had plans to re-release the movie.
"One of the reasons I chose to reissue the films rather than do a convention or one of the other things that was suggested for the 20th anniversary was at the time we thought about all of this, I had a 2-year-old son," Lucas would later explain. "And I thought, I'm not going to show him the film on video. I'm going to wait and let him see it on the big screen, the way it was meant to be, and let him really be overwhelmed by the whole thing."
The re-release also presented a chance to touch up the film. Lucas recalled in a 2000 interview,
"The opportunity to fix the film came along with the 20th anniversary celebration. There were a lot of ideas bandied about what we were going to do. Everybody, both at Fox and Lucasfilm, said, we've got to do something. This is an important thing to us. It's an important thing to a lot of our fans. We should celebrate the fact that we've been here for 20 years. I said, if you're going to put that much money into reissuing the movie, I want to get it right this time.
The opportunity allowed Lucas to finally fix the technical limitations he had been lamenting about for nearly two decades, such as an underpopulated Mos Eisley and unconvincing creature effects. As Mark Cotta-Vaz reported in ILM Into the Digital Realm, in late 1993, special edition work commenced, with a brainstorming session between Dennis Mirren and art director Tyrubin Ellingston, with Lucas's major interests being expanding Mos Eisley and adding the discarded Jabba the Hutt scene. The initial scope of it involved just two dozen shots, Tom Kennedy said to American Cinematographer. Mirren then suggested that the release offered the opportunity to correct a list of 15 to 20 shots that had always bothered him. I suggested to George that we expand the vision, and he was open to it, Mirren later said. Motion issues, particularly in the space battle scenes, were my concerns. Then Tom Kennedy and the others contributed their own ideas for redoing shots. What was more, the advanced digital techniques that would be put to use in the special edition would serve as an extensive test run for the prequels.
We called it an experiment in learning new technology, Lucas said, and hoped that the theatrical release would pay for the work we had done.
Lucas's enthusiasm for the project was starting to bring much more ambitious revisions. Lucas's main priority was the prequels, though, which he slowly but surely began to work on. His first task to complete was the writing. This was not an easy one. Lucas had to sketch out an outline, not just for the first film in the series, but for all three, expanding his original material with details, specifics, and characters. One of the benefits of designing the entire story before a single script was completed was that the trilogy would have a purposeful arc and a logical continuity. Although the original trilogy had a unifying arc to it, it was still hampered by the fact that it was mostly a patchwork of improvisations. Now, Lucas would finally have the chance to design a true master plan from the beginning, and stick with it. With the story's ending already revealed in Episode 4, he had a clear finishing line in the plot progression. But perhaps a testament to the fragility of creative planning, even this would be upheaved, as we will see throughout the coming chapters. Lucas dusted off his old binder and pored through his notes, many of them written down nearly 20 years earlier. Some were still valid. Some had been written out of history by subsequent changes he had made while making Empire and Jedi. For much of it, he had yet to write anything, and for others, there were multiple alternatives. Who was Mother Skywalker? What were the Clone Wars about? Where did Boba Fett fit into it, if at all? What were Obi-Wan and Yoda's origins? In other areas, Lucas would change his mind from his original ideas. The actual original pre-1983 outline itself was only brief in length and vague in content. Lucas's description of it wavers from 7 pages to 12 pages. The actual length of it is almost certainly the lower estimate, roughly 7 pages. And that also appears to include the background information, miscellaneous notes, and character sketches. Lucas basically lumps these all together into one description, which he terms the outline. For example, when describing it on the Star Wars 2004 DVD commentary track, he says it has plot point description, character background, and general information on the environment, a loose and vague collection of miscellaneous notes that, taken together, provide a sort of backstory. It seems as though it is not an actual 7-page narrative summary of the prequel story, the way many might assume, but rather it is merely 7 pages of notes, perhaps many of the very ones excerpted in chapters 2 and 3 of this book.
It's mostly historical background that's not pinned to any particular story, he says of the outline. I have a little story treatment, a little outline that says this happened here, this happened here, he continued. Where the characters came from and what they did. It's only about 7 or 8 pages.
His task was not as easy as it seemed. At first, progress was slow, with Lucas casually juggling many different jobs. He continued to run his companies and raise his three children. He continued to produce other projects, such as the remainder of the Young Indie series and the feature film Radioland Murders, a project he had been planning with Willard Hike and Gloria Katz since the days of American Graffiti, and which would be another testing ground for digital technology. He continued to work on the upcoming Star Wars Special Edition, and finally, he continued to work on the writing of the prequel trilogy. Quotes from McCallum and Lucas suggest that the first planning stages occurred as early as 1992, but mostly in 1993. That year, Rick McCallum began recruiting a writing partner, as Lucas had initially planned on handing his eventual first draft over to an additional writer, as he had for the previous two Star Wars films. He turned to Young Indie alumnus Frank Darabont, who would soon be enjoying success for the critically hailed Shawshank Redemption. Darabont remembers in an interview with Creative Screenwriting,
"I was approached very early on in the process. In fact, I was in the cutting room with Shawshank, late 93, I guess that would be. Rick McCallum called me and said, 'Hey, we're starting to take the preliminary steps to do the next Star Wars. And George would like to know if you're interested in performing screenwriting services for him down the road.' I said, 'Sure, what are you, kidding? Pin me to the wall, twist my arm, be happy to. Give me a call when you guys are ready.'"
Pondering how to tackle the series, the promise of constructing films that would alter the original trilogy appealed to Lucas's experimental sensibilities.
"I became fascinated by the idea of making a new trilogy that would forever change the way we see the original movies."
Obi-Wan Kenobi had long been envisioned to be the protagonist of the prequel trilogy. The films would not follow Anakin, but Obi-Wan, with Anakin Skywalker's fall seen through his eyes. The true pathos of the trilogy would hence be the failure of Kenobi and the betrayal of their friendship. As Lucas had said years earlier, they were the young days of Ben Kenobi, and every description of them before the early to mid-90s described them as such. However, as Lucas set out to write the trilogy, reflecting on the story and speculating on its execution, a realization obviously dawned on him. Far more tragic and powerful than Obi-Wan's story was the story of Anakin himself, the story of a brilliant prodigy, corrupted by greed, manipulated by an evil ruler, and cast into darkness. As Lucas began to come up with a more detailed outline, the story of Anakin gradually and naturally wound its way into the forefront and overpowered Kenobi's, being intrinsically more interesting and offering more opportunity to develop a character and add dramatic interest. It was an obvious story point. With Return of the Jedi placing so much emphasis on Anakin Vader, the original trilogy was unexpectedly shifted in favor of him. So much, in fact, that the final moments of Return of the Jedi, when the true meaning of the saga comes to crystallization, are revealed to be between Anakin and Luke, father and son. The original trilogy could hence be viewed as largely the saga of a son battling his father and finally redeeming him to goodness. With Anakin being an important player in the films, with the story of episodes 1 through 3 mainly revolving around him and his fall from grace, it became clear that the Star Wars saga could be told as the story of Anakin Skywalker, beginning with his discovery and ending with his death, broken into 6 chapters and 2 trilogies. Although Lucas had often described the original 3 films as chapters of a book, the book itself was the original trilogy, and the prequel trilogy was still described as another book, such as in Denise Worrell's 1983 article. Now those 2 books were being combined into 1. This joining of the 6 episodes into 1 epic film surrounding the character of Anakin Skywalker, however, introduced its own problems. The original concept of the prequel trilogy came about from the 1979 three-trilogy plan. Each trilogy would have different characters and a different style, and the nine films would not form one large tale, but three separate ones, which were chronologically connected. The subsequent prequel story was proposed with this in mind. However, the series was now becoming a six-chapter narrative which told a single tale, yet the stylistic disconnectedness from the initial plan remained. The prequels were melodramatic and tragic costume dramas about a hero's fall from grace, while the original films were light-hearted adventures about believing in yourself and the value of friendship. This posed no issue under the original structure, but now that the two trilogies were being merged into one saga, an inevitable disconnectedness would result between the two sets of films, which explains why many viewers still have difficulty seeing the six films as one saga and not two separate trilogies. This was a major milestone. Prior to this, the prequels were more of a tangent, a filling in of backstory, fleshing out the history of events and characters from the three Star Wars films as a separate series unto itself. As the prequel trilogy began to be written, the roles of the main characters thus switched. Obi-Wan's failure was now seen through the eyes of Anakin, with Obi-Wan now being the secondary protagonist and Anakin the primary. When exactly this occurred is up for debate. Although it seems Lucas still favored Obi-Wan as late as the early 90s, likely it occurred when reviewing his notes and sketching out the prequel outline around 1993 or so, although Lucas's comments in 1992 may perhaps indicate it had occurred around this time, though his description is inconclusive. While here we have the primary transformation of the narrative framework, this framework was still not as acute as it would be in the trilogy's final form. As will be examined in Chapter 13, the Anakin-centric story would continue to swell in each coming sequel, while at the time of Episode 1 it was comparatively understated. Lucas had a chance to explore a truly complex character in Anakin, one who begins the story noble and heroic, but undergoes a horrible transformation into a twisted figure of evil. Lucas's original outline had only detailed the character's final hours as a Jedi, when he fell to the dark side as an adult. Even his initial discovery by Obi-Wan seemed to have occurred when Anakin was a young man. Lucas, however, wanted to use the character to explore deeper issues about the roots of evil. Rather than present the character of Anakin as a demon seed, a dark character whom always had a murderous streak in him, Lucas opted to present the character as a good-natured human being, a person full of compassion and enthusiasm. He stated on the Episode 1 DVD commentary track, "One of the key elements in the introduction of Anakin and the development of Anakin in Episode 1 was that I wanted him to be a very earnest, very honest, very good-natured person, just the opposite of the way you think of Darth Vader. Because the larger story is really, how does a sweet kid like this turn into something as evil as Darth Vader? Part of the story is how does he become bad? What choices does he make to become bad? Not, well, he was bad to begin with, so it's obvious that that's where it was going to go." Lucas decided to explore this concept to its full potential. As a result, he set the story much earlier than he anticipated. In order to fully explore the innocence and subsequent fall of Anakin, and in order to give motivation for Anakin's eventual turn, he went back to the character's childhood. This was a significant deviation from his original plan. Lucas's first story had been that Anakin and Obi-Wan grew up together on Tatooine, together becoming war heroes and Jedi Knights, until one of Obi-Wan's students, Darth Vader, slew Anakin. When Empire Strikes Back turned Anakin into Darth Vader, he ceased to be Obi-Wan's equal and thus became his student, and therefore the original storyline no longer made sense. With Return of the Jedi, Lucas provided an alternate, as Obi-Wan explains, "It seems Obi-Wan, already a Jedi Knight, discovered Anakin, recognizing that the young man was strong in the Force and would make an exceptional Jedi prodigy, and took it upon himself to train him. This discovery was carried over to the prequels, and the original plot point that Anakin grew up on Tatooine residually remained, with the events now occurring in his childhood. You can see the different accounts being mixed into a new version that adds unique elements of its own. While Lucas had to create a whole new set of worlds and develop the basic characters and plot for all three films, he also had to balance them against the original trilogy to make sure the series was consistent. This last point seemed especially troublesome, as Lucas's changing storyline had brought unexpected inconsistencies, a problem he had struggled to overcome in the previous two films as well. He told Laurent Bouzereau in the making of Episode 1,
"In writing Episode 1, I spent a lot of time doing research. I had to develop an entire world. I had to make a lot of decisions about things that would affect the next two movies, as well as this movie. Everything had to be laid out in the script so that the next two scripts would follow as they should. I also had to play this script against the three movies that had already been made, making sure that everything was consistent and that I hadn't forgotten anything. There was a tremendous amount of minutiae in these movies that I had to consider."
Elements of a story. Perhaps the most complex plot point to write was the one that would nonetheless become the crux of the trilogy, that of Palpatine's rise. When Lucas originally wrote the storyline in the 70s, Palpatine was merely an unscrupulous politician who seized power through bribery and manipulation, taking advantage of a government that had lapsed into corruption, declaring himself emperor. It also appears, hinted at in the Star Wars novelization, that there were actually a long line of emperors that were really just puppets of the bureaucracy, who were the real menace. However, starting with Empire Strikes Back, the character was made more evil and sinister, a supreme ruler that even Vader bowed down to, and in Return of the Jedi, was revealed to be a satanic sorcerer. Lucas now decided that Palpatine was a Sith, a fact that had never been officially confirmed. The Emperor was a master of the dark side in the original films, but not necessarily part of any official order, and the term Sith had never even been used in the films. However, Lucas now was faced with a slight dilemma. How does an evil Sith Lord get into politics? It was plausible for Palpatine to manipulate himself into office when he was merely a corrupt politician, but he was now presented as a black-robed, lightning-spewing Dark Lord. To solve this, Lucas came up with the dual persona of Palpatine Sidious. Palpatine's manipulation into office was now much more complicated than before, and must have cost Lucas many hours to flesh out the complex subplot, the majority of which was so subtle and intricate that it went over the heads of most viewers. Rather than seizing power in a coup, Lucas had always envisioned Palpatine manipulating the state and the people into handing over power to him. Lucas tells USA Today,
"This was written during the Vietnam War and Nixon era, when the issue was how a democracy turns itself over to a dictator, not how a dictator takes over a democracy."
Palpatine's rise to power would coincide with the Clone Wars, a subject of much mystery, and though Lucas had toyed with many different concepts back in the days of the original trilogy, the vagueness of the war allowed him free rein to make up whatever he wanted. The expanded universe, a term given to the comics, books, games, and other forms of media which expanded the franchise beyond the films, had since touched upon the Clone Wars, implying that an army of Mandalorian warriors, of which Boba Fett was a member, fought a vicious battle against the Jedi Knights. This was, of course, based off a small blurb that appeared in the summer 1979 issue of Bantha Tracks, where they were not called Mandalorians, but shock troopers, as well as the Empire Strikes Back novelization. However, Lucas decided to disregard all the expanded universe material and instead linked the Clone Wars directly to Palpatine's manipulation of the galaxy. In the second draft of Star Wars, it was stated that the Republic grew corrupt from within, and war and terrorism persuaded people to accept a police state. Now this notion was realized as the Separatists, a group of dissenters who caused a civil war and launched terrorist strikes upon the Republic, eventually becoming the enemies of the Clone War. It also seems that the Clone Wars, in Lucas's original conception, vague as it was, occurred much earlier than what we would be shown in the films. The macro event of the Clone War was thus now shifted to a micro event, an event personally connected to Palpatine. This type of alteration would be a continuing trend in the writing of the prequels. As the epic plot was condensed into a personal tale which closely linked together events and characters, the scope of the Star Wars galaxy was becoming considerably smaller. Palpatine's manipulations begin even before the events which open Episode 1. Secretly a Sith Lord, Darth Sidious, with an apprentice, Darth Maul, the time has finally come for the Sith to return from secrecy, after being wiped out by the Jedi a millennia earlier. Although Lucas had created the Sith as far back as 1974, their order would undergo as drastic a change as the Jedi had. In addition to rewriting Palpatine as a character named Darth Sidious, Lucas also had to redevelop who the Sith were, how they came to be, and why they went away. He explained to Bill Moyers in a 1999 Time article,
"One of the themes throughout the films is that the Sith Lords, when they started out thousands of years ago, embraced the dark side. They were greedy and self-centered, and they all wanted to take over, so they killed each other. Eventually, there was only one left, and that one took on an apprentice. And for thousands of years, the master would teach the apprentice. The master would die. The apprentice would then teach another apprentice, become the master, and so on. But there could never be any more than two of them, because if there were, they would try to get rid of the leader, which is exactly what Vader was trying to do. And that's exactly what the Emperor was trying to do. The Emperor was trying to get rid of Vader, and Vader was trying to get rid of the Emperor. And that is the antithesis of a symbiotic relationship, in which if you do that, you become cancer, and you eventually kill the host, and everything dies."
Thus was born the so-called Rule of Two, a complete turnaround from the previous incarnation, in which they were a warrior clan with many members. A more detailed history between the Sith and Jedi was fleshed out in Terry Brooks's Phantom Menace novelization. The name Darth also underwent a transformation, initially being Vader's first name. Then, in 1978, the alias Darth Vader became Anakin's Sith identity. Now the word Darth became a Sith designation. See Appendix C, Dark Father, for more information. The greedy trade barons mentioned in the second draft of Star Wars, as being prominent in the galaxy's fall, became the Trade Federation of the film, showing Lucas's distrust in the political entanglements of corporations. Palpatine is a man with two identities: his true self, the twisted Darth Sidious, and his unassuming alter ego, Palpatine, a gentle senator from the quiet and peaceful planet of Naboo, or Utapau in the initial draft. He contacts the Trade Federation and sets up a clever ploy whereby the planet is blockaded due to a dispute over trade routes. Finally, an invasion occurs after Palpatine is able to exploit a loophole in the law, with the people enslaved in camps and the queen on the run for her life. On Coruscant, the galactic capital, Senator Palpatine is able to use the victimization of the peaceful Naboo to expose the corruption and uselessness of the current Supreme Chancellor, and a vote of no confidence is enacted. The dire situation creates a sympathy vote, and Senator Palpatine is ushered in as the new elected ruler of the galaxy. His apprentice, Darth Maul, is slain by Obi-Wan Kenobi, and so Palpatine searches for a new apprentice as he begins to enact Phase 2 of his plan. He secretly commissions a clone army to be created, based off bounty hunter Jango Fett, father of Boba, to be used 10 years later. The corruption in the Republic has led to civil unrest, and Palpatine uses his persona of Darth Sidious to create and foster a separatist movement, threatening to bring civil war to the Republic. After being in office for 10 years, the clone army is ready, Palpatine has found a new apprentice, and the separatist army, secretly controlled by Palpatine himself, declares war on the galaxy, beginning the fabled Clone War. The Jedi, sworn to protect the Republic, reluctantly become soldiers in the war, decimating their numbers, while Palpatine uses the situation to manipulate the people into giving him emergency powers, slowly turning the democracy into a dictatorship. As the war wages on, the Jedi begin to suspect Palpatine and turn on him, but Palpatine is able to manipulate Anakin into siding with him. Finally realizing that Palpatine is a Sith Lord, the Jedi attempt to assassinate him. They fail, and Palpatine uses the incident to frame the Jedi as traitors. The clone army turns on the Jedi, and Anakin falls to the dark side and begins hunting down the survivors. Meanwhile, Palpatine declares himself Emperor and turns the Republic into the First Galactic Empire as a means of guaranteeing security, as the Clone War transforms into a new civil war. Anakin is near fatally wounded in a duel with Obi-Wan on the site of a volcano, but Palpatine rescues his apprentice, resurrecting him as Darth Vader, as the dictator consolidates his rule of the galaxy. Palpatine's schemes, however, are plagued with setbacks and defeats, and as a result, he must reevaluate his plan. Initially, it seems the Trade Federation was contracted to supply the army for the Clone War, with the Queen of Naboo to be captured and executed, leaving Palpatine, able to avoid the invasion due to his senatorial duties on Coruscant, to use the tragic death of her as a springboard to vote out the Supreme Chancellor and elect himself in place out of sympathy, with his apprentice Maul filling in the enforcer role Vader would eventually inherit. However, the Jedi's interference leaves the Queen safe, the Trade Federation defeated, and Maul slain. But Palpatine is able to improvise and better his own situation, such as using the Queen herself to vote the Chancellor out of office, and noticing young Anakin, whom he begins grooming for future Sithhood. With a plot as elaborate as that, it is no wonder that it took Lucas so long to write the scripts, and this was merely the outline. During the writing of the prequels, the Jedi Order itself underwent a fundamental change. The Jedi first were conceived in Journal of the Wills as intergalactic super police, having their own army, requiring training at an academy, and providing military services, such as escorting cargo through hostile territory. They reappeared in the rough draft of Star Wars, and were now more closely based on the samurai warriors Lucas came to be familiar with through Akira Kurosawa's films. As the drafts went on, sci-fi mysticism and E.E. Smith's Lensman mixed in with the samurai aspect to create more superhero-like characters partly reminiscent of the original Journal of the Wills presentation, and a wizard-like spin provided by Alec Guinness, and the character of Ben Kenobi gave them a quasi-magical quality that emphasized their spiritual aspect. The final product introduced to audiences in Star Wars was that they were a mystical police force, a mysterious group of warriors which anyone could be recruited for, and who called upon the powers of the Force, a power which anyone could learn to harness if only they believed in themselves. Even in the sequels, the Force was usually seen in a mystic, spiritual light, but Lucas brought back the superpowers he may have originally envisioned, such as acrobatics, telekinesis, and levitation. For the prequels, Lucas decided to make the Jedi into outright religious monks, a route that the comics and novels had been heading along as well. This, of course, was born out of the strong Zen Buddhist overtones of Yoda in Empire Strikes Back. Appropriately, Lawrence Kasdan and Irvin Kershner are both Buddhist, and although Lucas was raised Methodist, he has not surprisingly professed heavy Buddhist leanings in the years since.
"I was raised Methodist. Now let's say I'm spiritual. It's Marin County. We're all Buddhists up here." During the initial period of pre-production for Episode 1, Lucas had toyed with his original concept of a more police-like Jedi, similar to the Templar Knights of Myth, the Lensmen, or the Samurai Warriors, as can be seen in Episode 1 production artwork, where Obi-Wan is portrayed in black body armor. Episode 1's rough draft explicitly describes him as being dressed in black. In the 1983 Return of the Jedi documentary Classic Creatures, Lucas remarked to Mark Hamill during a costume fitting that his new militaristic black costume was Jedi-like. However, in redeveloping the Jedi Order as a dogmatic, monk-like organization for the prequels, their visual look shifted accordingly, presenting them clad in priestly robes. At one point during the Episode 1 design, we were thinking of the Jedi as lone samurai, then as teams of samurai. Concept designer Ian McKeag said in The Art of Episode 2, "They were going to be like a police force, dressed in black and a lot more militaristic, but they evolved into the peacekeeping force they are in the current film." The designing of the prequel costumes was described by Laurent Bouzereau. "Everything from full body armor to long, flowing capes were considered for the Jedi's costumes, although Lucas eventually went back to the designs from the first trilogy. George wanted to make sure that when the audience saw these characters for the first time, it would immediately register that these were Jedi Knights," McKeag explained. "For these characters and for Yoda, we had to establish some familiarity in the costumes with those existing films. I looked at the original Star Wars costumes to understand the style and influence, and I realized that those designers were very medieval, so we kept to that." However, this decision was based on a major oversight. The Jedi garb of the original trilogy was not Jedi garb at all. Obi-Wan wore the standard desert robes of an inhabitant of Tatooine, modeled after Middle Eastern dress. In fact, Uncle Owen is dressed in almost the exact same costume. Yoda as well is not wearing Jedi robes, but merely handcrafted rags. This problem may have been fostered due to a misinterpretation in Return of the Jedi, when Anakin appears in spirit in the final scene. Rather than coming up with a proper Jedi costume, he was simply dressed identically to Obi-Wan, perhaps creating the confusion that his clothing, identical to Obi-Wan's and similar to Yoda's, the only Jedi ever seen in the films, was the traditional Jedi garb. There is at least an in-universe answer. Since Anakin is from Tatooine, his traditional clothing might be the same desert garb that Uncle Owen and Obi-Wan wear. In any case, this decision is a minor but often forgotten evolution. And certainly it may confuse future viewers who may be wondering why everyone on Tatooine, especially Uncle Owen, is dressed as a Jedi. The Jedi were also now made to indoctrinate potential members from infanthood and forbade any attachment to loved ones, like Buddhist monks. This was presumably done to tie into Anakin's tragic flaw, and thus serve as his main motivation for turning to the dark side. In this light, the Jedi were more like a dogmatic religious institution, with strict codes, organized councils, and their own private society, the complete opposite of the swashbuckling paramilitary warriors of the original film. Here, their heroism was also reinterpreted, portraying them as sowing the seeds of their own demise with their arrogance, complete with an ivory tower temple where they reside. Lucas also chose to include Yoda in the films. While in Empire Strikes Back, he was simply a wise man, a shaman on a holy mountain, or a Zen master isolated on a monastery, designed and written as if a part of Dagobah itself, with its primordial swamps teeming with life, Lucas was now faced with a dilemma. If the Jedi were an organized religious society, with councils and a bureaucracy, then he had to decide if Yoda, whom the original films had portrayed as the wisest and most powerful Jedi of all, would partake in the galactic intrigue. Lucas engineered a new interpretation of the character, placing him in an urban metropolis as part of the political scene. Lucas had not come up with a personal history to Yoda in the original films,
and while his role in the backstory could simply be ignored back then, fitting him in tangible terms, would now drift Yoda into a much different character than his former depiction. Slowly, as each element in the prequel trilogy underwent subtle but significant changes, a new storyline was seeping out. In developing Anakin's character, Lucas realized that, like all tragic heroes, he had to have a tragic flaw, or hamartia, as it was known to the classic Greeks. The most common flaw amongst the classic tragic heroes was hubris, arrogance, or pride. This was the flaw that Obi-Wan Kenobi had, the tragic quality that led to his failure to train Anakin and his subsequent guilt over the consequences. In time, this quality would shift from Obi-Wan into Anakin, as he would become overconfident in his own abilities. But perhaps the main tragic flaw that Lucas would create for Anakin would stem from his attachment to loved ones, his possessiveness and his fear of loss, an influence Lucas obviously took from his Buddhist beliefs, main tenets of which are these exact issues. The main plot device for this was the separation between Anakin and his mother, the primary reason Lucas set the first act of the trilogy to occur during Anakin's childhood. With the Jedi's outlaw of attachment, Anakin is wrenched away from the only person who ever loved him, his mother, a point made all the more severe when Lucas decided to make him born into slavery. Eventually, he's to be reunited with her as she lay dying, an event that traumatizes him so much that Anakin takes his first step towards the dark side by slaughtering her captors and vowing that he will never again allow a loved one to die. This vow is complicated by his love for his wife, whom he quickly begins to have dark premonitions about, just as he had of his mother before she died. Fearing that he will lose the love of his life, Anakin is offered the dark side by Palpatine as the ultimate power. As Palpatine's years-old plot to turn Anakin and the galaxy against the Jedi finally comes to fruition, Anakin's vow to save his wife from death tragically leads him on a quest for control and ultimately to the dark side, as he is slowly consumed by its tempting power. This seems to be the basic skeletal plan that Lucas drew up when crafting the journey of Anakin. The details in between would be mostly invented on the fly as he wrote the actual scripts, but he had a clear plan for the character's arc. Episode 1 would pose the question, how does a good person become evil? Episode 3's answer is summed up by Lucas during a press interview at Cannes as the film was released.
On the personal level, it was how does a good person turn into a bad person? And part of the observation of that is that most bad people think they are good people. They are doing it for the right reasons.
Anakin's acceptance of the dark side as a means to grant him the knowledge and power to save his loved ones is also reminiscent of the tragedy of Faust. Faust is a medieval legend whose precise origin is still unknown, which concerns a man named Faust, who in his quest for greater knowledge or wealth makes a pact with the devil, named Mephistopheles or Mephisto, which ends up costing him his soul. This legend was most famously portrayed in a play by Christopher Marlowe, first published in 1604, but performed at least a decade earlier. In continuing the thread of storytelling borrowing, the late 16th century Faust legend, which Marlowe based his play on, is actually taken from an earlier legend concerning Theophilus of Adana, who makes a pact with Satan in order to make himself elected bishop in the 6th century. Luke and Leia's mother, a character shrouded in much mystery, would figure strongly into Anakin's turn, and now her character had to be developed. Lucas decided to make her into a person of politics, similar to Leia's role in the first Star Wars, in order to include her in the galactic intrigue and keep her involved in the story. Lucas set her up as the Queen of Naboo, an elected teenage ruler, in order to involve her prominently in the events of Episode 1, which Lucas had now unexpectedly set in the days of Anakin's childhood. Anakin develops an innocent crush on her, and in the second episode, the two of them now full adults, they would fall in love and secretly get married. Setting her age as a 14-year-old queen allowed her to realistically have a relationship with Anakin some years later, and was also an idea from the 1974 rough draft of Star Wars, in which Princess Leia was 14, being based on Princess Yuki from The Hidden Fortress, who was the same age. Episode 1's rough draft, however, would state only that her age is hard to determine, but she is a young woman. Without Borders. As Lucas explained to Leonard Maltin in 2005, Episode 1 was most troublesome because he had to devise a plot from scratch.
The one we worried about the most was Episode 1. The backstory wasn't meant to be a movie.
Lucas's decision to set the events of Episode 1 during Anakin's childhood had drastic effects on the rest of the story, however. For one, the original storyline had been conceived as occurring across a time span of only a few years. Now it spanned well over a decade. As a result, the first episode contained very little of the original plot, while the second, and especially the third episode, had to be condensed. Instead of the events occurring across three films, they were now compressed into two.
Episodes 1 and 2 were character pieces with a lot of exposition, he said to the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Episode 1 was a film about a kid, the young Anakin Skywalker, and Episode 2 was his coming of age. The problem is that 60%, maybe 80% of the backstory is contained in Episode 3.
The story would hence be spread much thinner than Lucas originally had intended, as Empire magazine reported in 2005. Only last month, Lucas, now 61, told an audience of fans what has been increasingly obvious since 1999. The Phantom Menace contained just 20% of this original outline's first three episodes. Ditto clones, the picnics and pod races, George confessed, were padding. Lucas may have numerically bound himself to three full prequels long ago, but for fans, the truly essential material amounted to one story, an origin story that still has a 60 to 80% remainder, Episode 3.
I did run into the reality of the first film, Lucas admitted to Static Multimedia in 2005. Basically, he is a slave kid. He gets found by the Jedi, and he becomes part of the Jedi Order, and that he loves his mother. You know, that's maybe a half-hour movie. And so I did a kind of jazz riff on the rest of it, and I said, well, I'm just going to enjoy myself. I have this giant world to play in, and I'm going to just move around and have fun with this.
The lack of original story material would actually become one of the prime draws to making the film. It would give Lucas the chance to essentially start over from scratch, to construct a truly limitless children's fantasy adventure film, without thought or worry about its connection to any sort of preset history or storyline. In 1976, after the disappointing reality of the compromising production of Star Wars, Lucas remarked,
"Someday I'll do another movie like this, maybe, which will be much closer to my original plan. I didn't get the illusion that I'd seen in my mind. I got something else, which is all right, but it wasn't what I started out with."
Now he would finally realize that far-out vision. As Lucas was developing the overall story for the prequel trilogy, he was also organizing its production with Rick McCallum. The plan was to follow the production guideline of the successful Young Indie shoot, where the episodes were filmed back-to-back in one long production period. The first film was expected to be released in 1997. With Episode 2 following in 1998, and Episode 3 in 1999. Lucas said in a 1992 interview with Lucasfilm Fan Club magazine,
"Shooting the new Star Wars films back-to-back has always been the plan. What we're doing is planning it out very carefully, like the Young Indie TV series. The production technique we're using in the TV show are going to be the kind of technique that we use for the Star Wars feature films."
This also meant that Lucas would have to write all three scripts at once. The workload was quite daunting. As Rick McCallum and production designer Gavin Bouquet embarked on a series of recces, reconnaissance missions to search for possible filming locations, in the summer of 1994, Lucas finally began preparing to write Episode I's screenplay. It had been 11 years since a Star Wars film had played on silver screens, and much in the world had changed. Was Lucas ready to go back? Chapter 10 Returning Home. In 1983, staring down the final curtain of his trilogy, Lucas reflected on what he was sure was going to be goodbye to Star Wars.
"I think what happens in a project," he said, "is you fall in love with the characters and you fall in love with the environment. It's like a home. You feel very comfortable making up things that happen there. It becomes your own little fantasy land. The reality is that I love that world. I mean, there are friends there. It's like a home. I have a home there. And so there's always going to be a desire on my part to go home again, or to be with my friends again."
Espousing the message of the original film, however, he would add,
"As attractive as the Star Wars world is, sooner or later you have to leave home and go on to some other place."
Over a decade later, Lucas finally touched his number two pencil to a blue-lined yellow pad of paper, held in the same binder in which he had written the original Star Wars. As important as it was to go on to some other place, he somehow found himself back where he started. On the morning of November 1, 1994, after taking his children to school, Lucas began writing Episode I. That eventful day was covered by a documentary crew, hired to record the process of making the trilogy. In the first segment of a 12-part series, initially released on the internet website StarWars.com, Lucas prepares for writing.
"This is the 1st of November, 1994. Today is my first day of writing the new Star Wars series. Took my kids to school this morning. My oldest daughter was sick all night. I got no sleep whatsoever."
He takes the camera on a tour of his writing office.
"I have beautiful, pristine yellow tablets ready to go," he comments, holding up the yellow pads of paper he traditionally handwrites the first drafts of his scripts on. "A nice fresh box of pencils," he continues, pulling out a rattling box of number two pencils from his desk drawer. "I'm all set," he says, and then slumps into his chair. "Now all I need is an idea."
His famous Star Wars binder is shown, containing all the notes on the history of the galaxy which he had accumulated and organized over the 20-year period, and which he meticulously expanded in preparation for the prequel scripts. The red 2-inch binder is full of tabs, with headings such as Character, Plot, Outline, Jedi, and Empire. Undated notes are shown, such as one detailing Anakin, which appears to be a recent creation. Ages 9 through 20 is written next to his name, the time span of his life which the prequels would occupy. The description is thus: "A boy who builds droids and races power pods, earnest and hardworking, who dreams of becoming a star pilot and a Jedi. Good at heart, blue eyes. Whenever he gets near a machine, he gets an intuition and knows what makes it work. Is he a mutation? Who was his father? Why was his mother outcast?" Lucas reflects on the writing process.
"It's great to be able to sit by myself and just be able to do this. It's like a real luxury, actually. And, you know, I don't feel a lot of pressure. It's kind of fun. I'm getting to do a lot of research, which I love to do, and I'm getting a chance to think."
On Lucas's bookshelves are shown dozens of hardcover volumes on mythology and anthropology, as well as paperback sci-fi novels by Edgar Rice Burroughs, Lee Brackett, and E.E. Smith.
"I think about scenes all the time," he continues, "and they come in a mosaic, and eventually all the pieces come together. And then there'll be some missing ones, and then I have to sort of sit down and really work hard to get from point A to point B."
Presumably, after the 4-minute documentary piece was completed, Lucas began writing the script.
"The story for the three new films was meant to be the backstory of the other films," he later explained to Laurent Bouzereau. "That backstory was sketched out in a rudimentary fashion when I wrote the first trilogy, and there were certain things I knew even then. I knew, for example, that there was a character named Anakin Skywalker who grew up on a small planet, had special skills, and was found by the Jedi. I knew where everybody came from, who they were, and how they got to be what they were. A lot of the story points were there, but the actual scenes and many of the characters were not.
As the making of Episode 1 noted, quietly, secretly, Lucas devoted 5 days each week to writing, while Rick McCallum traveled the world in search of locations. As of November 1, 1994, George Lucas was officially writing another Star Wars picture. The traditional opening scroll read, "It is a time of decay in the Republic. The taxation of trade routes to the tiny planet of Utapau is in dispute. Hoping to force a resolution with a blockade of deadly Star Destroyers, the greedy Federation of Galactic Traders has cut off all shipping and supplies to the small, peaceful planet. While the Congress of the Republic endlessly debates the alarming chain of events, the Supreme Chancellor has secretly dispatched a young Jedi Knight to settle the conflict." The script told the story of Obi-Wan Kenobi, a Jedi Knight, and Anakin Skywalker, a gifted slave child. The peaceful planet of Utapau is invaded by the nefarious Federation of Galactic Traders. But Obi-Wan Kenobi, after uncovering the invasion plot, intercepts the captured Queen Amidala and flees the planet with her retainers, including the bumbling Gungan Jar Jar Binks, whom Obi-Wan saves in the swamps of Utapau while en route to secure the Queen. Their ship is damaged and forced to land on the desert planet of Tatooine. In the first draft of the script, it is Obi-Wan who uncovers the invasion, meets Jar Jar, who speaks normal English, saves the Queen, ventures into the city of Mos Espa, and discovers Anakin. Qui-Gon does not appear until the Coruscant section, and Obi-Wan's characterization is essentially that of Qui-Gon in the final film, having many of the same lines and mannerisms as well as being an older, full Jedi Knight in his 30s. Obi-Wan discovers the gifted slave child Anakin Skywalker on Tatooine, and through a reckless but ultimately triumphant wager with Anakin's owner, Watto, the boy's freedom and the hyperdrive part the Queen's ship requires is won in a spectacular pod race. Before Anakin enters the race, as they sit in Anakin and his mother Shmi's hovel, Obi-Wan asks him if he fears or hates his rival Sebulba, to which Anakin replies, "No." "He doesn't know he's bad," Anakin says. "He's full of pain, and I think he is afraid of me." Obi-Wan says that fear is the root of all evil and the path to the dark side. He tells Anakin that the greatest challenge a Jedi must face is to resist the temptation of fear, the fear of letting go of things, possessions, friends, yourself, accepting change. Just before they depart for the pod race, Padme notices Obi-Wan staring out a window of the hovel. "You look like you're trying to solve the problems of the universe," Padme says. "Only our own," Obi-Wan replies. "But maybe they will become the problems of the universe. I don't know." It appears that Obi-Wan senses that this seemingly small-scale struggle will have larger, darker ramifications for the galaxy as a whole. After Anakin has won his freedom, Obi-Wan makes him an offer. Obi-Wan has recognized that Anakin is strong with the Force and wants him to come with him to the Jedi Temple on Coruscant to be trained as a Jedi. Anakin agrees, but is forced to leave his mother. As they depart, they are attacked by Darth Maul, a Sith Lord, and Kenobi fights him. The two combatants are shown levitating objects, moving extremely fast, and vibrating to the point of becoming almost invisible. They also leap over one another in an incredible display of acrobatics. Obi-Wan fends him off, and they escape to Coruscant. There, the Queen meets with Senator Palpatine, where they plan to bring their case before the Senate. Obi-Wan meets up with his former master, Qui-Gon Jinn, whom he introduces as "my mentor and good friend," and they bring the boy before the Jedi Council for evaluation, where they inform the Council of the new Sith menace. The Jedi Council, which consists of three Jedi Elders, Mace Windu, Yoda, and Ki Adi Mundi, agrees to test Anakin. But Yoda warns Obi-Wan that while the boy's existence was foreseen, he is too old, and his future is blank and dangerous. Qui-Gon takes Anakin to the tower for testing, while Obi-Wan remains with the Elders. Mace tells him, "Anakin will be returned to you after the test. He is your ward now, Kenobi. You realize there is little chance he will be accepted. You must decide what is to be done with him." Later, Anakin tells Obi-Wan that he didn't understand the Jedi tests, to which Qui-Gon replies, "You were not meant to." Obi-Wan says the Council will make a decision after reviewing the results. Valorum is not removed from office in these scenes, and instead the Senate proves useless to resolve the Queen's dilemma. She decides to return to Utapau to take back her planet from the Federation army. Valorum protests and vows to force the Senate to deal with the matter before the Queen gets herself killed. Qui-Gon accompanies Obi-Wan back to Utapau with the Queen's entourage, with Anakin in tow. In order to bypass Utapau's blockade of battleships, Kenobi comes up with a plan of coming out of hyperspace right in orbit. The ship's captain protests that no computer is capable of that, but Obi-Wan has a plan. He brings Anakin to the co-pilot's chair and says to him, "Think of yourself racing. Take the controls. We're heading towards a planet. Concentrate. Stop right before the surface." Anakin closes his eyes, and as everyone waits tensely, he brings the ship out of light speed right in front of the planet. The Utapau freedom fighters then make a plan to siege the capital. Setting aside their differences, the Gungans help them with their army, 10,000 strong, and Jar Jar courageously becomes a war hero, while Anakin and Padme take part in the battle, and together they pilot a two-man starship and destroy the droid control ship. Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan battle Darth Maul, but eventually Qui-Gon is struck down. Battle droids attempt to enter into the facility and aid Maul, but Kenobi uses the Force to slam the door shut, crushing several droids in the process. Throughout the battle, the two warriors use the Force to hurl objects at one another. Soon afterwards, Padme and Anakin destroy the droid control ship, and the battle droids in the generator area begin running into the walls. Maul wades through the droids, cutting them down to get to Kenobi, and finally they stand face to face.
"Your style of fighting is old, but I understand it now," Obi-Wan says. "You learn fast," Maul replies. "You don't bother to learn. I don't have to."
Before Maul can act, Kenobi lashes out and cuts the Sith warrior in half. He studies his fallen enemy and says,
"Learn not, live not, my master always says."
The Federation of Galactic Traders is defeated, and Utapau is saved. Palpatine reveals he has become Supreme Chancellor, and the Jedi Council agrees to train Anakin. After Qui-Gon's funeral, Yoda calls the boy forward. Anakin kneels, and each Jedi comes forward to touch the boy's forehead. A final victory parade on Utapau ends the film. On January 13, 1995, the first draft of Episode 1 had been completed. The script was titled The Beginning.
"Writing the script was much more enjoyable this time around," Lucas said to Laurent Bouzereau, "because I wasn't constrained by anything. I didn't have to say to myself, well, I can't have one of these creatures because there's no way to do it with a guy in a suit. You can't write one of these movies without knowing how you're going to accomplish it. With CG at my disposal, I knew I could do whatever I wanted."
Lucas had finally taken all of his newly created and organized notes and made his first attempt at writing. Much of it was new to Lucas himself. In an interview with Johnny Vaughn on the Big Breakfast television show in 1999, Lucas dispelled some public preconceptions. Johnny Vaughn:
"The way I imagine it is that George has this great big leather book covered in dust. It's the Chronicles of Space, and you've written the whole thing already, and it's complete in your own mind. Is that right?"
George Lucas.
No, that's wrong.
You don't have the complete story mapped out from the start all those years ago?
No.
Okay, nice one. So you're winging it?
No, I have a little story treatment, a little outline that says this happened here, and in the first one, I had all the scripts, but I had to rewrite the scripts so they went along because since they became three movies, they had to have different structures and things. But the ones I'm working on now was the backstory which I'd written out, which was this was where he comes from, this was where he comes from, this is what the Clone Wars were about. It's just a little outline that goes right through the plot of the movie and where the characters came from and what they did. It's only about 7 or 8 pages.
Oh, that's brilliant. All those people think you've schemed the whole thing up. But in fact, George Lucas, he makes it up as he goes along.
Because Lucas had to think up almost the whole film, only 10 to 20% of Episode 1 was taken from his original material, progress was unexpectedly slow. The plot for the next two films was largely pre-existent. However, Episode 1 was uncharted territory, with the only premeditated plot points being that Obi-Wan discovers Anakin, which did not even survive in the final film, and that Palpatine ascends to Supreme Chancellor, occupying one scene in the finished piece and absent from the first draft. Lucas had to come up with a totally new and original story. Or perhaps not as new and original as it first seemed. In his struggle to devise an actual plot for Episode 1, Lucas went back to the same source which he had borrowed from when plotting Star Wars in 1973, Akira Kurosawa's The Hidden Fortress. The film told the adventurous story of a general samurai who attempts to escort a royal princess to safety across enemy territory, and along the way picks up two bumbling peasants who add comic relief as they are pursued. The princess switches place with her bodyguard in order to avoid assassination, donning the disguise of a peasant, and they eventually find themselves in a small local town, where they must barter for additional transportation and end up buying a slave girl's freedom, who then joins them on their adventure. In Star Wars, the samurai had been Obi-Wan, the princess had been Leia, and the peasants had been the droids. For Episode 1, the samurai was once again Obi-Wan, the princess was Queen Amidala, and the peasant was Jar Jar. Instead of delivering Princess Leia from her captors to the safety of the rebel stronghold on Yavin, Queen Amidala is delivered from her captors to the safety of Coruscant. And instead of Princess Leia deciding to take a stand and fight back against the Death Star to save her people, Queen Amidala decides to take a stand and fight back against the Trade Federation to save her people. Phantom Menace even sticks to some specific plot points of Hidden Fortress more closely than the final version of Star Wars. The Japanese town the group stops at while disguised as farmers becomes Mos Espa, which Qui-Gon and Amidala also venture into dressed as farmers. They end up bartering for transportation, just as in Hidden Fortress, and buy a slave's freedom, just as in Hidden Fortress, who accompanies them despite the protests of others. The plot points of trade routes and war treaties echo down from the rough draft of Star Wars, which had minor appearances of such things. Other elements, from handmaidens to a master Padawan duo protecting young royalty to a peaceful planet being invaded and occupied, can also be found in the rough draft of Star Wars. The Podrace set piece also has its roots in early Star Wars lore. The wonderful 1981 Star Wars radio drama was a 13-part adaptation which expanded upon the unseen moments in the film. And among its most memorable was the introduction of Luke, voiced by Mark Hamill himself, in a thrilling T-16 Skyhopper race with his anchorhead friend Fixer, as they precariously swoop through Beggar's Canyon at breakneck speeds. The concept of Naboo, or Utapau in this draft, and Theed City as a Romanesque garden city perched on top of a beautiful waterfall can be traced to James Gurney's famous children's book Dinotopia. The first in the Dinotopia series, Dinotopia, A Land Apart from Time, was released in 1992 and became an award-winning New York Times bestseller. The story revolves around a 19th century scientist and his son, who are shipwrecked and discover the magical city of Dinotopia, where humans and dinosaurs live together. The books were renowned for their stunning artwork, which depicted this lush world. A comparison of Theed City to the Dinotopia city reveals a nearly identical copy, and the film's parade finale is a direct port of the finale.